Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. The invention of synthetic nitrogen was one of the most important scientific discoveries in world history. Without the Haber-Bosch process, millions may have starved, and the world today would be a vastly different place. Author Thomas Hager tells the story of the two scientists who discovered how to, as he poetically describes, make bread out of air. The book is titled The Alchemy of Air, and Thomas Hager joins me in the studio. Welcome. Nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Some of you would know some of Tom Hager's previous books. He's a very experienced science and medical writer, particularly The Demon Under the Microscope. He happens to live in Eugene, Oregon, which is another great blessing for him and his family. And you can join my conversation with Tom Hager, please. As always, our email address is drshow@wamu.org. 1-800-433-8850 is our phone number. Now, we talk about making bread out of air, but alchemy is an old concept of making something valuable out of something ordinary. Talk about why you titled the book The Alchemy of Air.
Well, I'm going to credit my publisher with helping a lot with that. Yeah, I used alchemy as a sort of sub-theme throughout this book. A lot of people are interested in alchemy nowadays because it has a kind of a new age spiritual and self-improvement aspect to it. But indeed, alchemists were famous for trying to make gold out of base metals. You know, you turn a lump of brass into gold or something like that. And that's very much what these inventors did, was they figured out a way to turn something absolutely worthless, which was the air around us, absolutely free, and turn it into one of the most valuable commodities on Earth.
Now, you say one of the most valuable commodities. Now, nitrogen, most people don't think of as a valuable commodity.
Yeah.
But at the core of your book is the argument, is to trying to get people to understand what it is and why it's so valuable. Tell our listeners.
Yeah. The thing about a lot of modern society, a lot of the world that we live in, really, is that significant inventions underlie our daily lives. Mm-hmm. And we sort of go through our daily lives and we flick on the lights and we have breakfast and we heat up our coffee and we never think about how all of those things are possible for us. But each one of the things that we're doing, and any time we eat a bite of food, we're really eating some technology with it. My book is about how a group of German scientists early in the 20th century made an enormous leap forward and really found a way to feed the world. Nitrogen is one of the most important elements that we use in our bodies. It's responsible for a lot of stuff in our bodies, and we have to have nitrogen. Every plant has to have nitrogen. Every animal has to have nitrogen in its diet. If you don't get nitrogen, you die. And we get it through eating protein and through eating plants and stuff, and plants get it from the ground, and the ground gets it from the air through a very complex series of chemical processes. What these Germans figured out was a way to pull out tons more from the air than nature could do. We improved on nature. And that's the reason that we have about 2.5 billion people on Earth than there should be.
But nitrogen, to understand the process here, you talk about fixed nitrogen, which can be used to fertilize soil and can enrich soil in order to provide this absolutely invaluable ingredient. Before these German scientists figured out a way to produce this synthetically, What you say in the book is there was an upper limit, that the natural occurring nitrogen was where it came from. Chile was a leading exporter of it, and what they did that made such a difference.
Sure, it's hard to imagine now, but around 1900, in the say 1850 to 1900, access to nitrogen was very similar to what access to oil is now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was an interesting analogy.
Yeah, there was sort of a nitrogen crisis. Nobody called it that at the time. They called it a food crisis. But what happened was that only so much nitrogen exists in the soil naturally, and it's put there very slowly by bacteria that take it out of the air. 80% of the air around us is nitrogen, but it's absolutely unusable. We breathe it in and breathe it out all day long, and we don't get any benefit from it at all. It's sort of inert. It's dead air, mostly. I hate to use that term on the radio. but what we need to do is to what's called fix that nitrogen, put it into a form that biological organisms can use, that plants and animals can use. And that process is very slow, natural process. There was only so much of it in the soil on Earth when humans showed up, and it supported all the life on Earth. It's what's called a limiting factor for life. Mm-hmm. Every plant system, every ecosystem is really dependent on a certain amount of fixed nitrogen. Well, what these Germans did was they found a way to double the amount of fixed nitrogen in our biosphere. They essentially are flooding the world with tons and tons and tons of fixed nitrogen that they're taking from the air artificially, and we're now putting it all around the planet. That's what's feeding
us. In the form of fertilizer.
In the form of fertilizer. That's the primary thing. The other thing that they found out, though, was that it made more than fertilizer. It also made explosives, and this was an important part of history, too.
Right. I'll get to that in a minute, but I want to talk about this food question because, of course, the notion from economist Thomas Malthus and others predicted doom and gloom in the world as the population expanded beyond the limits of the globe to support it. Mm-hmm. And there was a famous speech you talk about in the book by Sir William Crookes in 1898, a British scientist, who talked about this, the need for synthetic fertilizers. And this is really the break point, right, for going from the naturally occurring to the synthetic, where you can vastly expand not only this product, but therefore the ability of the Earth to sustain larger populations.
Yeah, a turning point in human history. And and that's a good point. In 1898, Crookes, who was the head of the British Scientific Association at the time, gave a speech in which he said, essentially, that the world is going to start starving, and the world is going to start starving around the 1930s. There's going to be mass starvation in the civilized world in particular, in Great Britain and the United States, because, he said, the population is going up really fast and food production is only going up a little bit at a time. All of the big grain-growing areas in the world were already under the plow, the Great Plains of the United States and the steppes of Russia and the wheat areas in Australia. All of that was being used for farming, but they were running out of food because you couldn't grow anymore on the land we had, and the population kept going up. So Crookes said, it's inevitable. We're going to start seeing mass starvation in our cities unless scientists find a way to solve this problem. And that was the setup for this discovery.
And these two scientists you talk about, the subtitle of your book, I'm talking to Thomas Hager, and his book is called The Alchemy of Air, but it's subtitled A Jewish Genius, A Doomed Tycoon, and the Scientific Discovery That Fed the World but Fueled the Rise of Hitler. And we're going to get to the Hitler part in a minute, but talk about these two people, the Jewish genius and the doomed tycoon, who are central characters in your book.
So Crookes gave this speech in England, and the call went out around the world for scientists to figure out how to feed the human species. So everyone started working on it. People in there, a couple of guys in the United States who started a plant near Niagara Falls because they used the falls for electricity, and they tried to figure out a way to use electricity to burn nitrogen out of the air. And there were groups in Italy and groups in Russia and groups in Denmark. There were groups all around the world. Well, in Germany, they saw this as a money-making opportunity. And a big company in Germany, a big chemical company called BASF, started looking for ways to get nitrogen out of the air and turn it into fertilizer, because they knew that if they could figure out that way to do it and they could patent the process, they would make a fortune. They would make an enormous fortune. It would be as if someone figured out a way to turn air into gasoline.
Yeah.
And so they put out the call to their scientists.
Very low-cost raw material, very high payout.
Exactly.
It doesn't take a graduate school, an MBA, to figure out that business model. Yeah.
Especially if you got if you get a process together where you are the only person who has access to that process, then you corner the world market. And that's exactly what they did. They put the word out. There was a German Jewish scientist who was already pretty famous, named Fritz Haber. And Haber had been working with ways of burning chemicals out of the air, doing pretty theoretical work. He was a university guy. But he came up with a method that he thought was going to work. And he made this little lab. He made a little prototype in his laboratory. It sat on a tabletop. And it was about like something you'd make out of an Erector set. But it was pretty advanced for the time. And he developed this extremely delicate way to balance pressure and heat and gas inputs and purification and cooling systems. And he jury-rigged this whole thing in his lab. And he actually got it to make a little tiny bit of fixed nitrogen, like drops of it at a time, came out of the other end. And when he saw those drops coming out of the air, when he finally figured out a way to do it, he ran all the way around his university calling people down to see his little machine chugging away and spitting out drops of fixed nitrogen. And in fact, that was the beginning of a worldwide industry and probably the richest industry in the world and the start of the biggest chemical company in the world at the time. BASF bought his invention and worked with him, with a fellow, a young chemist named Bosch. They put this young guy with the old guy. They worked out a way to ramp up this invention from a tabletop to a factory the size of a small city.
Wow.
And they started pumping out nitrogen.
And it worked as a fertilizer.
It worked as a fertilizer beautifully. In fact, the product that it makes is ammonia. Ammonia is a nitrogen atom and three hydrogen atoms bound together. That's a molecule of ammonia. And you can put ammonia on a field and it'll make a sort of a fertilizer by itself. But then what you do is you take the ammonia, that's what you turn air into, and then you can turn it into other stuff. You can turn it into a lot of different fertilizers. You can turn it into explosives and many other things. They had a way of making a fortune. They were the only people in the world who knew how to do it. And it looked like they were going to be a kind of the Rockefellers of their day. But then World War I hit right then.
Well, Tom Hager is the author of this new book we've been talking about, The Alchemy of Air, a Jewish genius, a doomed tycoon, and the scientific discovery that fed the world but fueled the rise of Hitler. And we're going to talk about not only the enormous benefits of this in terms of feeding and fertilizing the world's food supply, but also some of the downsides of it, as you point out, in explosives and gases and other products. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Give us a call, 1-800-433-8850. We've got some lines open, and we'll get to those calls and comments as soon as we come back, so stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane today, and my guest this hour is Thomas Hager. His new book, The Alchemy of Air, a Jewish genius, a doomed tycoon, and the scientific discovery that fed the world but fueled the rise of Hitler. Join our conversation at 1-800-433-8850, drshow@wamu.org. And Tom, we're talking about the enormous benefits from this discovery in terms of increasing the world's food supply, but very significant downsides, starting with the fact that the similar process could create explosives.
Yeah. Let's talk about the upside first. You know, the invention was made primarily to feed the world. That's what they were hoping to do. That's what the challenge was. So they figured out a way to make air into fertilizer. And right now, every time you take a bite of food, you can thank those two inventors, Haber and Bosch, because about half the nitrogen in the food you eat comes out of one of their factories. Mm. And that means about half the nitrogen in your body came out of one of those factories. It's synthetic in a way. And I mean, not to worry about it. It's just, nitrogen is nitrogen. You don't have to worry about it. But it shows how important this discovery is. They figure now about 2.5 billion people on Earth are alive only because of this invention. There are huge factories now using this technology, pumping out rivers of fertilizer that are being thrown onto fields all the way around the world. And that's the reason we have a lot more people on Earth than the Earth can support naturally. We're about 2.5 billion above the natural carrying capacity of the Earth. We can thank this invention for that. That's the good side. The downside is that the same products could be used, as we've said, to make explosives. When World War I hit, the factories that they built to feed the world were turned into armaments factories. And the same process was used to make TNT and high explosives for shells and gunpowder for guns. And they estimate that because the Germans were the only people who could do it, they estimate that the Germans were in World War I 2 years longer than they would have been without this invention.
And one of the footnotes here, of course, we all in America are familiar with the tragic explosion in Oklahoma City, where basically the explosives that was used was nitrogen fertilizer.
Yeah, it was. It was doped with some accelerants, but yeah, that was it.
But there was also your subtitle about fueling the rise of Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
The contributions here went beyond the explosives. There were other products, other compounds that resulted from this, the work of these two scientists.
Again, when you follow the trail of science, I'm sort of a detective myself. Mm-hmm. When I do research, anybody who does research knows this feeling. Mm-hmm. You go in, you start to unravel a story, and you find threads that go in different directions. And this story started so many other stories. And one of the most important was that the same technology that they developed, this high-pressure, high-heat chemistry that they built into huge factories, they tried to figure out other things it could be used for. What else could they make? And they figured out that they could make synthetic gasoline out of it. Synthetic gasoline is a hot topic now because everybody's concerned about energy. And the Germans started making tons of synthetic gas back in the 1930s. That synthetic gas was used during the Nazi era to fuel the Luftwaffe, the Hitler's Air Force, and its armed forces. They estimate that in 1944, just as the war was beginning to wind down, Germany was making 3/4 of its own gasoline.
Because it had very few, if any, natural reserves of its own. And as the war proceeded, their access to remote sources of fuel were really drying up.
Absolutely. Not only were they making 3/4 of their own gasoline in factories out of the air, but, well, actually out of coal and the air. They were transforming coal into gasoline through this process. They were making 3/4 of their own gas, and their gas reserves at that point were higher than they were at the beginning of the war. It's an incredible feat, a technological feat.
Sure.
And in fact, the factories that were making synthetic gas were so important that that became the Allies' number one military target. The factories that made synthetic gasoline had more anti-aircraft batteries, more air defenses around them than the city of Berlin did. They were that vital.
Wow, they're that vital.
Yeah.
And also there is the use of some of these processes to create the gas that was used in the gas chambers.
The inventor of the process, Fritz Haber, was this German Jew, and a fascinating, conflicted character. He was a very, very hardcore German patriot. And in the years before World War I, a lot of German Jews were.
Mm-hmm.
They were intent on assimilating into German society and proving that that Jews could contribute to German greatness. Well, he was in that camp. He did everything he could to help Germany. During World War I, after having made this important discovery with nitrogen, he put his brain toward developing a secret weapon that would win World War I for the Germans. His idea was poison gas. Gas that would be heavy enough to stay at ground level and would terrorize the enemy. He engineered the first mass gas attack in World War I and was branded a war criminal.
Wow.
Yeah. And then after the war, of course, Hitler came to power. And despite everything he had done for Germany, Haber, who by then was heading his own institute, was stripped of his position, had to resign his position, and died a brokenhearted man.
Because he was Jewish.
Because he was Jewish.
But the use of these processes for I think the gas was called Zyklon B.
Yeah.
There is a connection there too.
Yeah, he after World War I, when he was working on these poison gas attacks, he kept up his interest after the war was over in secret. It was against treaties to do any sort of research in Germany for war purposes. Haber kept up a secret double life. in a couple of different ways. Hmm. And one way was that he made deals. He helped broker deals with countries that were looking for poison gas to use against their enemies internally, like in the Sahara, and other in Spain. There were countries who wanted that technology. He helped partner people with people. He also led a secret life where he tried to figure out a way to pull gold out of seawater. And he tried to, because Germany owed tremendous amounts of money after World War I, called reparations payments, billions and billions and billions of dollars in reparations payments. That was breaking Germany economically. Haber thought he'd solved the problem by going around the world and taking seawater and pulling gold out of it.
And finally, one more question. We're going to get to our callers. There also is a tremendous environmental fallout today because the very process, the very compounds that have contributed enormously to higher yields also runs off, goes into streams. Those of us in the Washington area are very familiar with the crisis in the Chesapeake Bay, which is largely attributed to the runoff of nitrogen-based fertilizers. Mm-hmm. Talk about that impact.
Yeah. So, you know, every scientific discovery is really a two-edged sword. And there's great benefits often, but there are also great dangers associated with science. In this discovery, you can see that playing out on a grand scale because here's a discovery that's really feeding about 40% of the world. If this invention hadn't been made, 2.5 billion people would starve to death. And yet, at the same time, it killed millions of people in the wars because of its use in explosives. And right now, it's back to its peacetime use. We're using it to grow food all the way around the world in enormous quantities. Well, what happens is every ton of synthetic fertilizer that goes on a field, about half of it ends up in the water. And just, you know, half of it ends up in the crops, pretty much. Half of it ends up in the water. It goes down rivers and into the ocean, and it triggers this cascade of events that kills waterways. They're called dead zones. And, right. And Chesapeake's an example, and the big one in the United States is in the Gulf of Mexico off of the Mississippi, mouth of the Mississippi. A dead zone down there the size of New Jersey now.
Let me go to some of our callers who and some of our emailers, and we'll start with I'm not pronouncing this, Juha Sittinen. He is a high school student from Finland, and we're delighted he's listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And he said, I would like to say I really love the show, and I'm also a very keen chemist and physicist. I would like to point out that you should talk about ammonia instead of nitrogen. Naturally, nitrogen is the most important piece of ammonia, but relative accuracy on the names of compounds should be maintained.
Absolutely right. And we were talking about the element, of course, right. which can occur in many, many different molecules. Ammonia is the primary product of this process.
And Ryan writes to us, Tom Hager, there are some who would argue that this invention only forestalled the inevitable and put us on a more disastrous collision course with our finite system, meaning it allowed for the continued overpopulation of the Earth and the continued ecological degradation that mankind is causing.
That's a very interesting point. And in fact, human beings, if you look at the history of science, it's a history of human beings outwitting nature or improving nature or working with nature mm-hmm. toward different ends. And this is a great example of how humans have looked famine, mass famine in the face, 1900 predictions of mass famine worldwide. They look that in the face and they figure out a technological trick to get around it. And the result is not just the pollution that we mentioned, but the fact that the Earth has 6.7 billion and growing number of people. That's a number that's doubled in my lifetime. It's a number that's quadrupled in the since 1900, since when Crookes mm-hmm. did his thing. Crookes made his prediction, and the world population is now 4 or 5 times bigger than it was then. And yet food production is so high that we're not only feeding everybody, but people are eating better now, that we're having an obesity epidemic. We're not having a problem with starvation at the scale that anyone predicted. We're having a problem with people getting fat. That's unprecedented. And it's absolutely true that this invention underlies, along with the green revolution, as they say, genetics, improved genetics for rice and wheat. Those inventions really led to the ability of humans to overrun the Earth. I use that term advisedly. There are way too many uh-huh. people on Earth for the natural carrying capacity of the Earth.
But you point out also in your book that when you say, well, there's plenty of food, some people say, well, there's still starvation. But you point out that it's really not a question of production of food. It's distribution of food that really causes the starvation that still exists.
Right now, we're in the unusual position in human history to have enough food to feed everybody very well. And potentially enough food to feed everybody for the foreseeable future as well. If we play our cards right, we will not see mass starvation unless there's political problems, problems with distribution of food. There'll be the ability to grow food worldwide is there. And this gets into another issue, which we won't have time to address, but that's the transportation of food from place to place. The way that the world food economy works, you got to move mass quantities of food from place to place.
So which uses up a lot of energy.
Which does use up a lot of energy.
Which raises the question raised by Greg, another emailer to us. Please ask your guests about the impact of declining oil supplies on the process they created. The current peak in oil production could have a direct impact on global food supply.
This is true. You know, what you're seeing right now, there's a food crisis, of course, in terms of price. The price of food is going up a lot, and everybody who goes to the grocery store knows that, and it's worse in poor countries around the world. Not that there's not enough food, but that it's expensive, and the reason it's expensive in great part is because the fertilizer that's made in these factories depends on natural gas, a lot of natural gas, pipelines full of natural gas. Oceans of water and seas of air go into this process to make the fertilizer. Well, as the cost of energy goes up, natural gas goes up, the price of fertilizer goes up. And when that goes up, the price in your store goes up.
Plus, as you point out, the transportation. This product is being produced at fixed locations and has to be moved from that to the farm.
You know, you think about small-scale farms, you know, family farms, and people in the old days, they would use manure from their animals to fertilize their fields. Well, now you've got these tanker loads of synthetic fertilizer that allow us to do monoculture, these big agribusinesses, these huge agri-farms, you know, that we've got now. That's all based on this technology.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have another caller who writes to us. Is there a connection between ammonia and cancer?
You know, I can't answer that. I didn't look into that in the book.
Okay. Let me go to some of our callers here. And Marie in Ponte Vedra, Florida.
Ponte Vedra, that's right, honey.
Excellent. Thanks for calling us. What's on your mind today?
Okay. Well, I knew a friend years ago who lived on a plantation down south, and he told me his father, every other year they would plant soybeans to put and then turn them into the ground to put nitrogen into the soil.
Right.
But it was organic back then. I mean, they used manure and things. Is the organic? I might have missed it if you did say this. Is that can catch on fire easily, like the synthetic nitrogen?
Well, you're asking several questions.
Can they use the organic for fuel also? Because boy, that would be great. I mean, we could have enough to fertilize crops and make fuel also.
Tom Hager, stay on the line, Marie, because I think there are several questions there. Tom.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting point. Thanks for bringing that up, because in fact, that's the slow, natural way to get nitrogen out of the air and put it into the soil. Are these bacteria that live on the roots of plants like soybeans and peas and clover, and there are some other things. And farmers have known this for millennia, and they do what's called they do crop rotation, you know, and they plant some of these nitrogen-rich crops every other year or third year or so.
Every other year, they do that to put the nitrogen back.
Absolutely, and it's a beautiful way to do it, but it's very slow compared to a truckload of synthetic fertilizer, and it takes a certain amount of care. Well, the one worry is that with the access to all the synthetic fertilizer, those skills are going to be to some degree lost. You don't want to see that.
Right.
Yeah, you don't want to see that.
Can they make fuel out of organic nitrogen? I was just wondering.
Not at this point. Interestingly, there's a lot of research going on into these little bacteria. Because we've got a process right now that works at very high heat, very high pressure. It's really difficult to do. And bacteria do the same thing, but they do it at room temperature, and they do it very naturally. And we're trying to untangle the magic that they're doing.
Yeah, it's a shame we didn't do this a long time ago. Instead of lie about it and, you know, privatize it, you know, and now maybe by now we wouldn't be in this spot, you know. And Hitler wouldn't have got a hold of that technology, you know, would have taken too long for him to do what he did.
Well, thanks for your call, Marie. We appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks a million.
But she also used the word organic, and this is, of course, a very important word in modern farming and to many of our consumers, many of our people listening out there. Is there an inherent contradiction between synthetic and commercially produced fertilizer and organic farming? Talk about that issue that our caller raises tangentially.
I'm not an expert in organic farming. Mm-hmm. However, I grew up on a farm that didn't run on a lot of synthetic fertilizer, and so I know a little bit about it. The trick, I think, is the difference not so much between organic and synthetic as it is between small scale and large scale. And what synthetic fertilizer allows people to do is to work on these enormous scales of, you know, train loads of fertilizer arriving, whereas in the old days, you would deal with cart loads of manure or compost or natural substances like that. In terms of the chemistry involved, synthetic fertilizer and organic fertilizers have the same nitrogen in them. The nitrogen is the same. There may be other things going on, but in terms of the most important element, the nitrogen, nitrogen is nitrogen is nitrogen. The problem is with how it's used, not necessarily how it's made. But we're in this system now where we've got access to huge quantities. Everybody depends on the huge quantities. You could say we're hooked on it.
And there is this trade-off, you know, because it's not just the size, but size also involves reduced costs of scale. Yeah. So you can produce cheaper food, but you have all of these trade-offs in terms of the impact.
It's a very, very active debate internationally.
Tom Hager, his book is The Alchemy of Air. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Give us a call, 1-800-433-8850, drshow@wamu.org. Tom and I will be back with your calls, your questions, your comments in just a minute, so stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to improve the voting process for all Americans at pewtrusts.org. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, whose four-day poetry festival starts September 25th in Waterloo Village, New Jersey, at dodgepoetryfestival.org. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how Dick Cheney became the most powerful vice president in American history and how he's used his power. We talk with Washington Post reporter Barton Gellman about his new book, Angler. It's an expanded version of the Pulitzer Prize-winning series of articles Gellman wrote with Joe Becker. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane today, and my guest this hour is Thomas Hager. His new book, The Alchemy of Air, a Jewish genius, a doomed tycoon, and the scientific discovery that fed the world but fueled the rise of Hitler. And Tom Hager, lots of emails, so let me try to run through these quickly. And we've touched on some of these subjects, but several make the point that naturally occurring plant, this is David, a PhD candidate in soil science, writes, naturally occurring plant available nitrogen is not rare, but rather underutilized. Perhaps the next green revolution will not be centered around an artificial means of nitrogen fixation, but a natural one, the use of human waste to create a closed loop of nitrogen cycles. And others write in about the process that our recent caller also mentioned, which is the plowing under of legumes and peas and beans and others that enrich the soil naturally. Talk about the questions of raised by our callers on that.
You know, I think there's a healthy and growing amount of interest in finding alternatives to these massive kind of heavy metal chemistry solutions that were mm-hmm. found a century ago. We're living off of this old technology. Very interesting and efficient technology, but it's got its downsides. And I think that it's well worth looking at alternatives and better, more ecologically sound alternatives to putting nutrients into our soil. I'm hoping that this research that's going on now into the enzymatic cycles of the nitrogen-fixing bacteria will yield something really wonderful.
And Ben from Bloomington, Indiana, on that subject says, I heard in the last year that scientists had invented a process to fix atmospheric nitrogen into a usable form that was much more energy efficient than the Haber process. Could you guess comment on the viability of this approach for large-scale production and indicate whether there are plans for large-scale production based on this new method?
I'm not sure what the listener was looking at. I do know that there is a better catalyst. There's a part of this process that relies on a chemical catalyst. There's a better catalyst that's been found at the industrial level that takes basically the same approach, but it lowers the amount of energy and makes it a little more energy efficient. That's going into effect now. On the other hand, there's a lot of this research at universities and other places into ways to do this at room temperature enzymatically using pathways more similar to the bacteria. And that may be what he's talking about.
And it would be therefore more energy efficient and use up less carbon fuels
in theory.
Donald writes to us, Tom Hager. This is a subject we've touched on before. The downside of cheap nitrogen is pollution. Farmers and suburban lawn lovers are flushing cheap nitrogen into our streams and bays, he writes, causing very serious problems for our environment. Are there any chemists working on a way to rid the environment of the excess of fixed nitrogen?
I think that the people who are working on the oceanography level, who are looking at dead zone chemistry and how to fix that, are very interested in the question of how to cleanse this. You know what happens in nature is that nature will clean it up on its mm-hmm. own, given enough time. Nitrogen is part of a natural cycle. And what we've done is accelerated that. We've kind of supercharged the cycle. We've doubled the amount of fixed nitrogen mm-hmm. in our biosphere. Right now, there's so much fixed nitrogen, not just in the water, but up in the air, too, because that's part of the cycle, that in many parts of the world, when it rains, fertilizer falls down with the rain now. Hmm. And it's altering the ecosystems up in the Arctic, in the tundra and Arctic forests in ways that we don't really have a good handle on yet. So it's going to be very important to study these questions. I am amazed at how far we have to go to figure out the downside of what we've created.
And finally, from our emailers, we had a lot of good ones today. Keon, if I'm pronouncing that name correctly, writes, could you ask Thomas to comment on the technology transfer that occurred after World War II? How did the U.S. and USSR benefit, if at all, from the technological advancements made by the vanquished Nazi regime?
That's a very interesting question. I'm going to step it back one step uh-huh. to World War I. At the outset of World War I, when this was new technology, the process that the Germans had invented, that Haber and Bosch invented, and by the way, they both won Nobel Prizes for this, the process they invented was so complicated and so new that when the Allies came in after World War I, they inspected the plants and they tried to figure out how to do it. And the Germans just laughed at them and said, you can look all you want at our machines, you'll never figure it out. And in fact, that was true. They couldn't figure out the technology. It was so complex and really brilliant. So the Germans looked for a while like they were going to have this world monopoly on the procedure. But then eventually some firms hired away, sort of did industrial espionage, mm-hmm. and hired away technicians and put up their own plants. And the technology spread. Well, after World War II, the big thing was synthetic oil, and that was the synthetic gasoline that was made in the same kinds of plants. The biggest plant in Germany was called Luna. Luna was a mile wide and 3 miles long. It was the size of a city. It employed 35,000 people, and it made about a quarter of all the synthetic gasoline for Germany at the time. That was a target of such a wave of bombing that bombers dropped the equivalent of an atomic bomb on that plant to try and stop it. And they bombed it into rubble, pretty much. And so the technology is known, but nothing has ever matched what the Germans did in 1943-44.
Let's turn to some of our callers now. And Jennifer in Chestertown, Maryland, right on the shores of the Chesapeake Bay. We're delighted to have your call. Please, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am interested in some of the environmental issues related to nitrogen, and you touched on water pollution and runoff from particularly fertilizers, both in farm use and in urban landscapes. I'm also a related question is the intensive use of fertilizers in places like the Corn Belt and in some of the former Soviet states where the nitrogen has percolated down into the groundwater and has contaminated groundwater with very high levels of nitrates that are associated with some pretty serious health problems. And I wonder if Mr. Hager could talk about that a little bit.
Great. Thanks for your call.
I touch on that very briefly in the book. Nitrate pollution, that nitrate is a form of nitrogen that many fertilizers will put into the water systems. Nitrate pollution is an issue for sure, and it can cause some pretty serious conditions in small numbers of people. It's nowhere near as dangerous at that scale, at least as far as we know now, as the longer-term ecological implications are. So you can put a lot of nitrate in the water. It can be dangerous to drink, especially for babies. They get a disease called blue baby syndrome, methemoglobinemia, if I'm saying that right. But compared to the other things that are going on, it may be relatively minor. You can take in a lot of nitrogen. Again, it's part of the natural cycle. And I'm not going to speak as a physician here, but that compared to the other problems, maybe not so much.
Let's turn to Scott in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Scott, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, how are you?
We're well this morning. What's on your mind?
I was at the North American Auto Show and learning about a new exhaust system for diesels. That uses ammonia. Can you talk about that a little bit?
That
I believe being made by Mercedes and BMW.
You know, that I know nothing about. I do know there's plenty of ammonia around, but how they use it in that way, I haven't a clue.
Right. It's a recirculating exhaust system, and somehow they use it, and they're saying the byproduct is water as part of the diesel burning process.
Well, that sounds like another show for us, but thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Right.
Let's turn to Robert in Delray Beach, Florida. What's on your mind, Robert?
I live on the seashore. Lots of seaweed on the beach, and it's bulldozed off for the sake of the tourists. The sea vegetables have more nitrogen than land vegetables.
You know, and that may be true. I can't go through vegetable by vegetable and tell you what the nitrogen content is. I can tell you that when the fertilizer runoff and all the nitrogen goes down into the ocean, it does fuel blooms of aquatic plants, and those plants drink up the oxygen in the water, eat up the oxygen in the water. And as the oxygen level goes down, the fish and the crustaceans can't live. And there's this toxic sort of cycle that starts in the ocean. So where there's a lot of nitrogen, you'll see a lot of plant growth.
Is Robert, is your implication that somehow this kelp could be usable? You say
yes.
You think it's a product that perhaps can be exploited?
Yes. You can eat it directly. It's very nutritious, and you can put it in your compost.
So it could have the same effect as the soybeans and the peas that we were talking about earlier. That it's perhaps
right.
This isn't.
We're just throwing away tons of it.
Yeah, you know, I know that in Ireland at least, and probably many other places, I would imagine Japan, seaweed has been used as a fertilizer for many centuries.
Thanks for your call. We appreciate it. Let's turn to another Florida caller, Greg in Fort Lauderdale. What's on your mind this morning, Greg? Welcome.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I found it fascinating that you said that the author said that the Germans made 75% of their gasoline from this synthetic gasoline from this process. And I wonder, with gas near $4 a gallon around the country, is this viable today? And of course, with technology 60 years plus advanced, do you think this could be utilized today?
The research is going on. There's a lot of interest in synthetic gasoline. What the Germans did was they turned coal into gas. Okay, so basically that's taking one fossil fuel that they had a lot of. They had a lot of coal in Germany, and turning it into another fossil fuel, which is gasoline. And it's not a particularly environmentally friendly process.
Of course, with the carbon release.
Yeah, exactly. And it takes some energy to do it, and then you're still releasing pollutants into the air when you've got the gasoline. However, I know a lot of research is still going on.
But their motive was that they had one carbon fuel that was domestically available. The oil they would have to import at a world at war, so their concerns about the environmental impact were pretty small at that point.
Thank you. This is a very fascinating topic.
Thank you for your call. We appreciate it. There's been a lot of talk in this country over the last few years of synthetic fuels, using, for instance, oil shales and other carbon products to create that the United States has more of, reducing dependency on oil that might come from unfriendly regimes. Do you see an uptick in the research here or not?
I think that all sorts of energy alternatives are being studied right now, and this coal to oil conversion process, you see news about it and people are interested, but it is expensive to do. Germany was compelled to do it because they had no other good sources of their own oil.
Right.
And if the goal is to wean yourself off of Mideast oil, say, then there are arguments to be made for putting the money into this because the technology has been there for 70 years and it's better now than it was 70 years ago. And Germany succeeded in doing that more than half a century ago. So if they could do it, well, I'm sure we could do it.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You're also listening to Tom Hager. His new book is The Alchemy of Air. And Tom, we have time for a couple of more callers. We have a lot of people who are interested in this subject. So let's go to Penny in Cortez, Colorado. Oil shale country, I think.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm sorry.
Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. My comment is about the sustainability or lack of sustainability of using artificial fertilizers and that we might not have the overpopulation on the earth, most likely would not, if we were not using artificial fertilizers. This is not a sustainable level of population, and I'm not saying I'd like to kill off anybody, but if the population were naturally to drop to a more sustainable level because we were feeding ourselves with organic fertilizers that could be not polluting our waterways and our oceans, I think the world would be a better place. We would all live much healthier lives.
Well, that's
my comment. I'd like your comment. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that's a subject that I grappled with. I know as I was thinking through this book about what it would take to get off of this synthetic nitrogen, the synthetic fertilizer that we're all thriving on now, the cost involved in moving towards, say that you wanted the entire world to be organic farmers and not use any synthetic fertilizer at all, but go back to what it was prior to 1900. You would have to face the fact that there would be mass starvation. We just have too many people now to avoid that, and mass starvation on a scale the world has never seen, and that stopped me cold right there. I didn't go any farther with that to think, well, would it be a good thing or a bad thing? I stopped with the fact that 2 billion plus people would starve to death.
But even on a micro, if not on a macro level, people are listening to us and they say, okay, I'm now much more environmentally conscious. I want to make my contribution. I'm a greenie. Are there things individuals can do? Does composting make a difference? Are there ways in which people can, in their own lives, reduce some of this kind of impact, or is this just beyond them?
That's a great question. You know, I'm a crazy composter myself.
Yeah.
I love making compost, and there's nothing more satisfying than turning your garden waste into some nice fertilizer. But that indeed has an effect. It's very equivalent to the small scale stuff that's going on in home energy use now, where people taking out their incandescent bulbs and they're plugging in fluorescents and they're driving less. And you know, I'll tell you that buying more energy efficient appliances, putting in better insulation, all of that stuff makes an enormous difference. And the same is true with fertilizer. The fewer big lawns that you have that you're putting bags of fertilizer on, the better off the waterways will be. farmers I know right now, because the cost of fertilizer is going up, they're looking at more efficient ways to spread it so that they lose less of it. That will make a big difference. There's a lot that can be done.
Time for one or two more callers, and let's go to Shay in Manning, South Carolina. Welcome. You're on the air, Shay. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. This is a fascinating program. About a year or so ago, I read a book called The Northern Lights, and it's about a scientist, and I'm probably going to slaughter his name, Christian Birkeland, who was Norwegian. And the book claims that he actually had the first patent for a fertilizer furnace in February of 1903, and that BASF actually duped him out of the credit for his invention. And I was just wondering if your guest had any knowledge or any information about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I that was one of the fascinating stories that I ran across while I was researching this book, and didn't have room to put it in among all the other fascinating stories that I found. Birkeland's story is amazing, and in fact, he did have he invented this wonderful method to create a huge flame like 6 feet across. He just this high voltage, high intensity flame that made a disc of flame, and then he could burn nitrogen out of the air with it. Beautiful system, and he got into negotiations with BASF just before they invented this other system. Once they got the other system, they dropped Birkeland.
Tom Hager, his book is called The Alchemy of Air, A Jewish Genius, A Doomed Tycoon, and the Scientific Discovery That Fed the World But Fueled the Rise of Hitler. Tom is also familiar to many of you as the author of The Demon Under the Microscope. Great hour. We had a good time. And thanks again to our listeners who had some good questions, some good emails. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. And Tom and I thank you for spending an hour with us.
Thanks.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.